I mean, Deuteronomy 15. And let's look at verse 7 and 8 first, verses 7 and 8. This is the general command that everybody in the land of Israel was required to keep. First one is, if among you one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within your land the Lord your God has given you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother. What form of language is that? It's in the imperative, isn't it? It's a command. You shall not harden your heart or close your hand. But you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it might be. Now, we said last week that if you don't have the means, you can't lend the aid. But if you do have the means, you should lend the aid. We also said last week that obviously there are people who are shysters who are trying to just take advantage of the system, and this law would not cover that. This is, that set those objections aside, and let's look at the principle. Help those in need is the principle. It's a command and that establishes that. Now look down, if you look down at verses 10 and 11, that command is reiterated. You shall give to him freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to him, because for this the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and all you undertake. So again, commanded generosity. That's the principle. Now, we saw last week the certain ways that command toward generosity is enfleshed in the law that God gave to Israel. Who can remember one of those ways? What are some specific legislation? What's the specific legislation that God established for the poor in Israel? Not slaves, but for the poor. Yes.
The year of Jubilee.
There's a Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee. The year of Jubilee is every 50 years. The Sabbath year is every seventh year. What happens in the seventh year? All debt is forgiven. Now we're going to see when we discuss slavery in particular, all debt slaves are also released. So all debt is forgiven in the seventh year. That's a huge one. What's another one? Chapter 4, yeah.
Can't do a second cleaning of your field.
Right. This is in Leviticus 19, verses 9 through 10. You go once through your field, and whatever you miss is left for the poor. And we see, for example, in the book of Ruth, Boaz, a righteous man, sometimes intentionally left. People are intentionally leave some things unharvested for the poor. Now, what's interesting about that is when the last time said, well, I think people should work for what they get. Well, what's wonderful about God's law here is that the poor don't just go and pick up a package of food. They have to go and harvest it themselves. So there's the dignity of work is maintained even in this law for laws to protect the poor. That's another one. Who knows another law that protects the poor?
Yeah. The corners of your field.
The corners of your field. That's not only do you not glean again, but you also leave the edges unharvested. That's also in Leviticus 19, verses 9 through 10. Anyone else have another one? Yeah?
In the seventh year, they weren't supposed to plant anything, and whatever food comes up was supposed to be for the poor.
Yeah, not only the seventh year is the Sabbath year in the sense that you get debt release and debt slave release, but also the harvest. You don't plant yourself. Everything that just naturally comes out of the ground in your fields is to be left for the poor, the sojourner, who's the alien in the land, the widow and the orphan. They come and they can take what they want. And you can't stop them from doing that, even if it's your field. That's what it's for. What else? Who's another one? Anyone? That seventh year cycle is found in Leviticus 25. And that's what that's. Leviticus 25, verses 35 to 36, and also verse 6. Another one is also, also in this whole section here, is that you cannot charge your Hebrew neighbor interest on any loan.
Right.
And if you have a Hebrew neighbor who's impoverished, you can't sell him food for a profit. Whatever it costs you to produce that food, that's when you can charge him. You can't charge him for your labor. You can't charge him for your just because you want to make some money off of him. It's a cost. We also saw that the third year tithe, every year you bring a tithe to the storehouse. On the third year, between these 7 year periods, you would bring the bulk of your harvest, both your barley harvest and your wheat harvest, and you would set it in the center of your village, and the poor and the sojourner and the widow and the orphan would have a free, they could come and take it. That is in the, let's see, which passage is that in? That is in Deuteronomy, one of those. I think it's Deuteronomy 14. Yeah, Deuteronomy 14. 14:28, that's the third year tithe. So it's very difficult. It's very difficult to be poor in Israel for very long. I mean, you have to really try to do badly. Or what?
If they really did those
things. If they really did those things. They're not, according to God's law, though, as it was supposed to be, if everyone was doing what was right, it would be a difficult thing to be poor in Israel. Because each one was supposed to care for his brother. Before we move on and talk about slavery in particular, notice this is all voluntary. There was no overarching large governmental system like we have today to prosecute those who did not, who could be gleaned twice, or who didn't give the third year tithe. You were just sinning. And so the obligation was on the part of the wealthy person to be obedient to God. And if that wasn't the case, of course, Israel was going to suffer ultimately, which they did. But that was the obligation. Okay, any questions about these principles and the laws of the flesh, the principle of generosity? Yeah?
You refer to that as the third year tithe, but in the seventh year, you're supposed to forgive all debt.
Yeah.
Would that be considered a seventh-year tithe?
No, this is the seventh year is just is an open forgiveness. No more. If whatever you owe me $1,000 and it's year seven, I just have to say, okay, you know what, Daryl? It's all yours. And it had to be a big smile on my face when I do it. Because that's what was, that all of these together would limit the openness for slavery. Most slavery was caused by being in debt.
Just before you said everybody brought everything like the center of town, and they gave to the poor, and that's part of the tithe.
That's part of the third. You have to tithe every year, right? So usually the tithe goes to the storehouse that cares for the Levites and those who are set apart to serve the Lord. The third year tithe between the 2 7-year Sabbaths in Deuteronomy 14 verse 28, that third year tithe, instead of taking it to the storehouse of the temple for the Levites, you set it in the middle of the village, okay, and wherever you live, and the people come and take from that amount that you would normally have given to the temple. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay. All right. Jerry, do you have a question?
You answered it. The 7 year period is a set period, right? From the time that they owe the debt, it's a set period for the whole nation.
For the whole nation. So if remember this, we looked at the legislation last week. If someone asks you for a loan on year six, you can't deny him that loan. If you have the money, you've got to give it to him. And then what that means is basically you're giving him the money. And so it's a difficult thing. Yes, Janelle?
So if, following the law is voluntary, or it's, not a governing body kind of saying, okay, it's your business, you have to, what would happen if you had someone who didn't want to forgive a debt in year seven?
Let me clarify that a little bit. If you look at the Leviticus, you see punitive laws for those who break certain laws. What's interesting about that, though, is you don't see too many punitive laws for breaking the generosity laws. So it seems like there was no set enforcement rule on those, and it was primarily a generosity thing. And so I think you could, I think you probably could appeal to the judges in the village where you live to intercede for you, but there was no forced redistribution. There was no, the judges didn't send a horse to your field and say, oh, give us that. And they didn't do that. And if you didn't forgive the debt, they didn't do that either. But so it was really a thing of the heart. It's kind of like it is now. I mean, I'm not going to I'm not going to send, I'm not going to call you up and say, why is your tithe this Sunday? You're out of the church now, you're not tithing. I'm not going to do that. It's just, it's your conscience, not my commitment.
So even if it wasn't enforced in the community,
yep.
I mean, Amos came and...
Oh, yeah, like the prophets enforced it.
The prophets and...
Yeah. What I mean by not enforce is you wouldn't have an armed police force coming to your property and collecting your wealth and giving it to somebody else. You would have Amos coming to you and saying, you sinner, repent and give to the poor. The point of the law, remember from God's perspective, is to show human beings our depravity, right? And if anything can show us our depravity, it's laws commanding generosity. I don't want to give my money to anybody else. I like my money, and I like my money better than I like you. So I'm not saying, I'm just being facetious here, but that's the general human perspective. So these commands should draw Israel to its knees in repentance and faith. Lord, help us fulfill these things, because we can't do it. That should be the idea. Yes?
Just have a little sidebar. The Endicott Johnson Corporation, they used to manufacture shoes at Endicott, had a farmer's market. And anyone in the community could go to that market, and you paid just what it cost them to have all the produce and other products in that market.
That's great.
It was great. It was in the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Right.
And the funny thing about this EJ market, it was quite large. It was nestled right in with the IBM Corporation buildings. So it was kind of a community kind of thing.
I've heard a lot about the E.J. Johnson Shoe Company. I heard they did a lot of good things. So that's a great example of generosity of a wealthy man.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way God would have intended for the wealthy to be in Israel.
Yeah.
Yes, Chris.
Yeah, Father Matt, think about running Israel's slaves. Isn't there a distinction to be made? Isn't there a distinction to be made between the centrality of the law and certainly the minutiae, which are very followable, very followable. I mean, all of us, many, many of us think here are Leviticus are eminently followable.
What's
yes,
this?
I can walk to shul if I don't have transportation. Yes, I can do this. Yes, I can do that. I can do most of it.
Right.
A lot of it.
Right, but then that's the whole trick with the law, because you get like commandments 1 through 9.
But you follow easily.
But then you get to commandment 10, which is don't lust or envy, and you think, oh. right. So and the same thing with the Deuteronomy laws. So if you look at Deuteronomy 30, for example, God says, I've given you all these commands. They're very clear. I'm not stuttering. You can do them. And you must do them with your whole heart.
Right.
That's
the hook.
Yeah, right.
But most of them are doable.
Right.
Very doable.
Yes, not in the way that God demands, but doable in the external sense. Yes.
And they're valuable in the external sense.
Absolutely. They're good laws, as we're going to see as we go on. Yeah, they're great laws. So, but
come
the point... I think what God intended to happen is Israel to remember to see its own depravity, not in a total sense, but just to see its need for God, Yahweh, repent, and then seek Yahweh's strength to fulfill His commands, instead of doing it on their own. So that's why the envy thing is there. That's why. All right. So let's go on and move into the laws for slavery. Let's look at Leviticus 25. And we're going to be looking first at the laws dealing with a Hebrew slave. Not a foreign slave, but a Hebrew slave. There were different laws. Leviticus 25. Notice first in verse... Verse 35, if your brother becomes poor, you cannot maim him. Verse 35 and 39 together are instructive. Verse 39 and 5 is, if your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall, it's command language, you shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner, which tells us what about strangers and sojourners, instead of the welcome and hospitality, right? And he shall live with you. Take no interest from him or profit, but fear the Lord your God, that your brother may live beside you. You shall not lend him your money at interest, nor give him your food at profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. All of this is intended for the poor brother to live with the, not have to sell himself out and to be there. But, verse 39, if your brother becomes poor beside you and sells himself to you, you shall not make him serve as a slave. That seems like a contradictory verse, doesn't it? He sells himself to you, but you shall not treat him as a slave. What's going on here in verse 39 is that the command of verse 35 is being fleshed out in this thing that we call, or that the Bible translates as slavery, and it's ebedship, I guess. The way, if a brother becomes so poor that he can't sustain himself, verse 35 gives you, one way that you can support him is allowing him to sell himself to you. And he shall be with you as a hired worker and as a sojourner. He shall serve with you until the year of Jubilee. Now let's see several things here. You're never to treat him as a slave. Now how would Israel know what it's like to be treated as a slave? They knew what chattel slavery looked like. Because among all the nations of the ancient Near East, Egypt practiced chattel slavery. Not many did, but Egypt did. And chattel slavery was the kind of slavery that you did own someone. It wasn't voluntary. It wasn't for the poor. It was for the rich. It was very different than ancient Near East slavery. Yes?
So is the word slave there not
Ebed? It is Ebed. Yes, so there's one. That's what's so hard about this. Is there's one word, Ebed, which covers relationships from chattel slavery all the way to the cabinet of Pharaoh's, you know, kingdom. So you're an Ebed of the Pharaoh if you're in his cabinet or his prime minister. So it's really difficult to discern exactly how to use that word. You get into context. Secondly, notice in this is in verse 50 and 51. He shall serve you until the year of Jubilee. Then he shall go out from you, he and his children, this is verse 41, with him, and go back to his own clan and return to the possession of his fathers. For they are my servants whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves. So another thing we learn here is that you buying this person only is, you can't buy a Hebrew. Why can't you buy a Hebrew? In a purchase sense, in a chattel slavery sense. Why can't you do that?
They're owned by God.
That's my slave, not yours. You can't buy that person. He's mine. You can use his labor, but you can't buy him. And then we have that seven-year release, as we saw there in that text. The entry here, notice verse 39 again. If your brother becomes poor beside you and sells himself to you, how is that different? What's another way that's different from antebellum slavery?
Voluntary.
Yeah, it's voluntary, right? So this, no one's going to kidnap people and forcing them into a labor against their will. This is someone who desires to be in the employ of his neighbor. So here, we just kind of paint out how the scenario would go. You have a bad harvest. You have a family to feed. No, you can't do it because you don't have enough food, but your wealthy neighbor next door has the means, and so you go to him and you say, I can't support myself. I would love to work for you. Can I do that? I'll sell my labor to you. He, if he has the means to support you, must say yes. That's commanded there. It's not an option. He can do it. He must do it. And what that means is he'll be paying for you, your home, your shelter, your food, and he'll be paying for your health care if you get injured. He's got to support your life during the time you're working for him. And then, at the seven-year release, he must let you go. We're going to see that seven-year release is not the only opportunity that you had to get out. It's kind of like a work contract. Any questions so far about what we're seeing in this? Does that sound a bit different than, you know, what you might think when you hear the word slave? Yeah. Now, okay. Yeah. It's more. It's. It may. But this. Notice the. You mentioned an indentured servant. It is a little bit like that. The. And one of the reasons people did go into this was because of debt. But it wasn't only because of debt. It was also because of just being impoverished. It could be because you owe the guy money, or it could be just because you're poor and you want to do it. The seven-year release, I think, is for the debt slave primarily. The person who owes money and he has to serve in order to get to pay the money back is released at that seven-year year period. Any other questions about what we just did? Yeah.
But he wouldn't have to serve the 7 years if he paid off his debt, right?
He wouldn't have to pay serve the 7 years if he paid off his debt. And we're going to see in a minute a clause in the law which just makes everything. Because I've been saying it's voluntary, but you might think to yourself, well, wait a minute, if he has to stay in this guy's service, how is that voluntary? He may voluntary in. Is he voluntarily out? Just real quickly, because this will leaven everything that we're talking about, turn to Deuteronomy 23, verse 15. Yes?
A lot of indentured servants came from Europe, and they couldn't pay they had to come over here, so they became indentured servants.
Right. Now, one difference, though, is that most indentured servitude situations, you were in. There was no escape. I mean, you were in for that period of time. If you got away, it was like it was against the law. You were breaking your contract. Now, in Israel, Deuteronomy 23, verse 15, I just want you to look at this. It's... you shall not give up to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. He shall dwell with you in your midst in the place that he shall choose within one of your towns, wherever it suits him. You shall not wrong him. Now, some have said that only deals with foreign slaves who are escaping to Israel, but there's no indication in the text that's true, and so lots of others say, no, it doesn't. That's a general prescription, and I think that's true. What this means is, let's say you're a servant, you've agreed to pay off your debt, and your master is really mean, like you're a bad boss. What do? You pack up your bags, you walk out the door, you go next door, and you say, can you give me shelter? By law, he has to. If he gives you up, he's violating the law. This wipes out the whole seven-year requirement. If you're in a situation where you don't want to be in anymore, if it's become abusive or exploitative, you leave. You're free. You're not owned by that guy. And again, this is not specific to sojourners or to Hebrews. It's a general command, so it applies across the board. The Hebrew cannot enforce slavery on a sojourner. The sojourner wants to walk out the door and go to another. Go somewhere else, and he can. He cannot be given up. And if the guy goes hunting for him, let's say the guy who thought he'd own this guy goes and looks for a tries to get it back. Look at 24:7, Deuteronomy 24:7. If a man is found stealing one of his brothers of the people of Israel, and if he treats him as a slave or sells him, then that thief shall die. You shall purge the evil from your midst. Now, what's stealing? That's kidnapping. That's holding someone against their will. If you're found holding a Hebrew against his will, you are violating the law. If you could turn to Exodus 21, verse 16, that law is broadened out, and it's not just Hebrews here. Whoever steals a man and sells him, and anyone found in possession of one so stolen or sold, Right, so let's say you go to the slave market over in Assyria and you say, hey, I'd like that one. You pick them up, you bring them home to Israel, they find that you've done that, death. Death. So this just breaks the, I think, all these three laws together, the get out of slavery whenever you want, Deuteronomy 15 text, the no kidnapping text, the anyone found holding a man against his will text, or a woman against his will text, all of those together just, I think, undermine any sense that the slavery we're looking at in the Old Testament is really slavery in the proper use of that word. We're looking at work. We're looking at employment. We're looking at someone willing to serve a person's household. Questions about this? Thoughts? Everyone satisfied with that? Okay. Good. Well, let's keep going then. Let's look at the... we've already seen how you enter voluntarily. We've already seen you can get out voluntarily. Let's look at... we've already seen you can see, you must set a Hebrew free slave, Hebrew slave free at the Sabbath year, but he can also go any other time that he likes. Let's look at the Deuteronomy 15, verse 16. I think it's verse 16. Where it seems to say, okay, you have a debt slave, or you have an impoverished slave. And he gets to that 7-year release period and he wants to stay with you. We're told, if he says to you, verse 16, I will not go out from you because he loves you in your household, since he is well off with you, then you shall take an owl, and put it through his ear. Now that would just stop that paper right there for me. I would not do that. And put it through his ear into the door, and he shall be your slave forever, and to your female slave you shall do the same. Now notice verse 18, it shall not seem hard to you when you let him go free from you. This is after the, if the slave, he chooses to go, for the half cost a hired worker. In other words, you haven't had to pay him wages. His wages have been your food, health care, and all the stuff you've given him. He has served you 6 years. The Lord your God will bless you in all that you do. Now the question that arises is this legislation intended to prevent the slave who wants to stay on after the 6-year period is over, the 7-year period is over, from going free again? It doesn't seem like that because, as we've already seen, there's an exit clause and there's a law against holding anyone against their will. What this seems to be is a law for the employer to say, if you can still hold this, if this guy is not able to be on his own yet, and he wants to stay with you because he's not able to be on his own, then you can't forbid him. I mean, the 7-year release is not a get out of jail free for you. You still got to support your brother unless he can get off on his own. That seems to be what it's stipulating. Don't think that you can use the 7-year release for your advantage. It's for the advantage of the poor. Questions, thoughts? No? Yep. A kind of patronage. Say more about that.
Does it seem to you like it's a kind of patronage at that point where perhaps the person who's poor needs a more powerful, in that sense?
Yeah, I mean,
benefit from a more powerful patron for a particular period of time.
Right. You can imagine them saying, I'm not able to support myself anymore and I need you to be my patron. And unlike other societies in Israel, if there were means available for the rich person to continue to support the poor person in that life, then he was obligated to do so. There was no release for the rich person. He had to help. Questions? Yeah.
What's to stop the poor people from taking advantage of rich people and just becoming slaves for the rest of their lives?
Yeah, that's a question. It's a good question. I mean, it's same. You know, notice here again, on both sides of this, we have God's call for integrity of heart. The rich person there's no enforcement. Right? He's called to be generous, and he can sin if he wants and not be generous. And vice versa, the poor person is called to work as part of the creation order. The poor person is called to work and earn his keep, and if he's taking advantage of his master, he's also sinning. Now, what kind of, I'm sure there's, you said a minute ago that within these villages there would be maybe some appeals to judges. There's nothing legislated that I know of that would indicate that, but from both sides, it requires voluntary love between the two people involved. And what God's... And ours. What God's doing here is he's bringing, remember we were saying how the intention in Genesis was that families together would work the garden and serve one another in love? And these laws are, by evoking generosity in the wealthy and service in those who are not wealthy, are pulling the human family back together. That's the idea here. It's a reestablishment of the original intent for labor in the garden. Remember, yes?
What comes to mind is how the Old Testament so ties into the New Testament when it speaks of slavery and things like us, and it's all free. But yet when we sin, we're a slave. We're a slave to Christ.
Yeah, we're all slaves. It just depends on who we're slaves to, right? Exactly. It is interesting when you look at the apostles, when they, Peter does this, Paul does this, John does this, when they, in the beginning of their letters, when they say who it's from, Paul will say, doulos of the Lord Jesus Christ, a slave of the Lord Jesus Christ. So will John, so will Peter. They all read this Old Testament very carefully, and they saw that, hey, I'm an Israelite. Jesus is the Lord God, so I'm his slave, but just like I was Yahweh's slave before. That the calling of themselves a slave to Jesus Christ is implicitly a claim of that Jesus is Yahweh, because the Israelite is Yahweh's slave. And it's also a recognition that no one owns the believer ever. You're owned by the Lord, and that's all. That's about set of their hand. Any other hands? Let's look at some treatment of slaves. And there are some difficult passages here. We've already seen in Leviticus 25, verses 35 through 43, that they're not to be treated ruthlessly. And we said the model for ruthless treatment was the treatment that they received in Egypt, which is that kind of chattel ownership, ownership slavery. We've seen in Deuteronomy 15, verse 16, which we were just looking at a minute ago, that the expectation on the part of God when he gave this law is that the treatment would be so well that there would be people who want to stay on. I mean, if this were antebellum type slavery, no one says, oh, can I stay longer? Can I keep this up? The assumption is the treatment is so well that they're not... that they're going to want to stay. Now look at Deuteronomy 15, verses 12 through 15. And in particular, at verse 13 through 14. When you let this person go free from you, you shall not let him go empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally out of your flock, out of your threshing floor, and out of your winepress. As the Lord your God has blessed you, you shall give to him. So this guy's been working for you for 7 years, or however long, and he wants to go. Not only have you had to pay for his health care and his food and his clothing and his shelter and that of his family for the last 7 years, but now you give him a head start when he goes out on his own to be able to provide for himself. You can't just say, all right, you're done, which you would in indentured slavery. This is a far better situation than the indentured slave. He's now given the means by which he might provide for himself. If there's any questions about that. Good. So again, the intention here is not to produce an existing system of slavery, but really to help people who are impoverished get back on their feet and begin again to live productively and independently. All right, so the verse Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 13, more on the treatment of slaves. And we're still primarily dealing with Hebrews here. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Verse 13, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall, on it you shall not do any work, you nor your son nor your daughter nor your male servant nor your female servant nor your ox nor your donkey nor any of your livestock nor your sojourners within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. There's a mandatory day off that all employers must give their employees. Which is, you know, far different from some even Christian business owners in our day who go to church on Sunday and make their workers work. So here's a command to let them rest, have a day of rest, just like everybody else. In chapter 12, verse 18 of Deuteronomy. You find... that during a major feast, I think this is Passover, I'm not quite sure, you shall eat, you should go to this seems to be one of the three major feasts, I don't know which, I think it's Passover, but you go to Jerusalem, you go to the place where God will show you, verse 18, and you shall eat your sacrifices before the Lord your God, in the place that the Lord your God will choose, you and your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, and the Levite who is within your towns, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God in all that you undertake, take care that you do not neglect Levite as long as you live in your law. So what's this saying? What is this saying? Just as you're having Thanksgiving dinner, then the people who work for you have to be invited. They're part of the feast. You're not allowed to make them work during that day, and more than that, they're going to take part in this family celebration, in this religious celebration with you. That's huge. That's a big thing. It, again, points to this bringing together of the human family that God is doing in the creation of these generosity and labor laws. The intent is to restore the unity and the cohesiveness of the human family that existed in the human garden. Questions about this? Good? All right. So, let's look at Exodus 21. Verse 20. And we're going to deal with some difficult passages after that. Exodus 21, verse 20. And there we find, actually, let's begin in verse 18. That's going to help us. This is a difficult passage. When men quarrel, and one strikes the other with a stone, or with his fist, and the man does not die but takes to his bed, then if the man rises again and walks outdoors with his staff, he who struck him shall be clear. In other words, he doesn't die, the guy doesn't have the death penalty. Only he, the one who struck, shall pay for the loss of his time and shall have him thoroughly healed. So if two guys get in a fight, injury takes place, there's a fine. And you pay for the guy to be healed. Now, verse 20. When a man strikes his slave, male or female, with a rod, and the slave dies under his hand, he shall be avenged of the death penalty for the killing of a slave, which, again, is rare. You wouldn't have that in a chattel slave situation. Verse 21, but if the slave survives a day or two, he is not to be avenged, for the slave is his money. Now, this sounds horrible, because it seems to undercut everything that I just said. What do you mean the slave is his money? Well, what that means is, just like the free man, when he was struck, was taken out of work for however many days, and the man who hit him had to pay for that. Well, in this case, you're talking about an employee who's making money for his boss. So he's out, and the boss has to pay for his health care during the time that he's recovering, and the money that he loses as a result of his striking his slave or his servant. Is equivalent to the amount that he would have had to pay had his servant not been a servant. You see what I'm saying? It's the loss of labor that is the cost issue here. So it's not any different than the free man. It's just, where is the money coming from? He's already paid it. If he's he's put this person out of his thing. Now, again, if someone strikes you and you're under their employ, what are you likely going to do? Right, you can't. You just say, okay, that's enough. I'm done here. I'm not working for you anymore. Thank you. And you can. You have to get out of free legislation. Get out of free of bondage legislation there, which helps you. If there's permanent injury, you can see this in Exodus 21, verses 26 through 27. If a man, verse 26, when a man strikes the eye of his slave, male or female, and destroys it, he shall let the slave go free because of his eye. If he knocks out his tooth of his slave, male or female, he shall let the slave go free because of his tooth. And then the legislation about setting free kicks in. You not only have to let him go free, you also have to provide for him liberally as he goes. So it's a huge cost. You've lost labor, and you also got to pay the guy and support him as he goes. So there's a lot attached to that. Questions about this? Thoughts? None? Anyone have any problems with it?
Yeah, what gives them the right to strike?
Nothing. That's the whole point. that's why the free man had to pay the fine to have the guy healed and pay for the guy's loss of labor. And in the same way, because this guy is the man's work, he's the man who, if the man's a slave or a servant, the time that he's lost in his employ is already paid for by the employer. That's, he's lost his money. That's what that means.
He's punitive
damage, civil damage. There are other, yeah. I mean, it's both for the free man and for the slave. They're only paid for the loss of labor when you do that. Now, with the slave, I think it's a little more dicey, though, because if you do cause permanent injury, you've got, not only does he go free, but you've got to pay for his upkeep. You wouldn't have to do that for a free man. You just wait till you just pay for his 2 days off or whatever it was.
Let's say he put his eye out.
Yeah.
Why would he want to leave?
Huh?
Why wouldn't he just stay there and be taken care of forever?
He probably, I guess he could. He could say. Right. But he doesn't have to leave. He's given permission. He's just go if he wants to. And then the guy has to provide for him liberally. Yes?
It just seems to me that every law book in the nation emanated from the Bible.
Well, there's lots of resemblance to some of these laws in our laws. So, yeah.
Why do we have so many lawyers?
But you also see, okay, now do you see, every once in a while you'll hear an atheist or a skeptic or someone who is a Christian but doesn't think the Bible is true say, well, the Bible supports slavery, and it'll take you to one of these passages. It'll say, look at this horrible text, and I hope we've seen that's a complete misunderstanding of the Bible.
Right.
It's also, it's not just a misunderstanding by liberals and skeptics, it's theological liberals and skeptics, it's also a misunderstanding by Bible-believing Christians back in the antebellum era, who used texts like this to support the institution. When the institution that they were using it to support was the exact opposite of what this is. This was for the poor, to help the poor, to support the poor, not to own, destroy, and exploit the poor. It's completely misused and abused of the Bible. Yes? Yeah. No, it is. You're right. It is where the work happens. I mean, this is not an easy subject. If you just take one passage about slavery out of the Old Testament context, you're gonna think this is horrific. But if you put it all together, we see that the concept is very much different. I mean, it's a restorative and it's a process that God uses to restore dignity and restore freedom, not take it away. Yes.
More like they don't. You don't own the person, you own their labor.
There you go.
You don't own their...
That's what this...
You own their service.
Exactly.
And which can be terminated at any time.
Right. No, I think that's exactly right. Now, another difficult passage, and I want to show you these because these can be People can show them to you and you think, oh, wait, I didn't know about this one. Exodus 21, verse 32. Exodus 21, verse 32. If an ox gores a slave, male or female, the owner shall give their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. Now, let's look at, let's go further up, verse 20, and let's begin in verse 28 so we can see the context. When an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall not be liable. Verse 29, but if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, and its owner has been warned, but has not kept it in, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner shall be put to death. Be careful about your dogs on a leash there. And its owner should, if the ransom isn't, it doesn't have to end the guy's life though. You could pay a ransom. If a ransom is imposed on him, then he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is imposed on him. So the family of the ones who is killed would say, all right, well, you owe this much to us. We're not going to stone you, but you need to pay some recompense for what you've done. If it gores a man's son or a daughter, she will be dealt with according to the same rule. And then we get to this verse 32. What happens if it gores a slave? Because at this point, it could be subject to a great deal of abuse. If you've already decided you're not going to have the man stoned for killing the slave, but you want to instead give him a ransom, how is it, because he's not your family member, how is it that you go about setting the ransom price? And so the law says, well, we're going to set a set price for the ransom of the person who is killed, who has let his ox or the slave. That's all that is. It's not saying the slave is only worth 30 shekels or the other people are worth more. It's just that saying that because this is not a family member, but there's no way to, we want to set a general price for the ransom. That's all it's doing. Yeah.
So I have one question about this. Does it say anywhere where if such a situation occurred where a slave was permanently injured or killed during this time, what would happen to the family? The person that they, because they were enslaved probably to support themselves, their family.
Yeah.
And now their family had no.
That's a good question. So how do you? You couldn't just kick the family out because you've already been courageous. You've already been commanded to support the widow and sojourner, the widow especially. So I think you would have to continue to support the family of the man who had been killed. So yeah, there's no shunting off to the side there. Yes. That's what we're. Let's look at it. I think I know what you're talking about. Let's look at the passage, that passage next, because it seems to be also very disconcerting, and it is one that people go to. It's chapter 21, verses 7 through 10. Oh no, maybe that's not. That's probably not the passage you're looking at. You're looking at another one, but let's do look at this one too, and then we'll get to yours.
What book is that?
This is. I'm sorry. It's Exodus chapter 21, verses 7 through 11. Oh no, you're right. It's actually the whole section. Let's look up at verse 20, chapter 21, beginning in verse 1. These are the rules. You shall set before them. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years. In the seventh year, he shall go free for nothing. If he comes in single, he shall go out single. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. So that's the implication that the master is obligated to take care of the family, not just the person. If the master gives him a wife and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall, this is where it gets kind of scary, the wife and her children shall be her masters, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I'd like to say, hey, you know, my wife, my children, I'll not go out free, then his master shall bring him to God, and he shall bring him to the door at the doorpost, and the master shall pour his ear through it to all women. All right, so what's going on here? Well, here we have to understand a little bit about the way marriage worked in the ancient Near East and also in the Old Testament. I mean, this is something, marriage was always arranged between two fathers, usually, And what would happen is you'd have a certain price paid by the father of the groom for the bride, and the that would suffice for the bride price. So the situation that seems to be here is that the master has arranged a marriage for this poor guy as he's working for him. And because the poor guy has been working for him, he hasn't been able to arrange for a bride price. And so all this is saying is the guy goes by himself, but until he pays the bride price or until he works out the arrangement, then there's no marriage. The marriage is there, but there's no... there's got to be a deal made. There's got to be the bride price paid. That's what that's saying. So it could be, and I think there are some evidence that are working out this way, that part of the bride price was simply accounted for when the slave went free and the guy paid liberally for his freedom. Some of it's done by like Jacob did. What did Jacob do? He agreed to work for 7 more years in order to pay the bride price for Rachel. So there's this, that's what this is about. It's not about breaking up families and making, forcing them to be apart. It's just, there's got to be a bride price. That's what it is. That's very foreign to our culture, so that seems odd. But that's just the way it was, and God is trying to regulate it so that the master didn't get cheated out of his investment, because he's been caring for that family for so long. All right, so... verse 7 through 10. One more thing about that. That would not break up the marriage. Like, let's say the guy had to leave. That wouldn't mean they had a divorce. That just means that, that wouldn't even necessarily mean that the woman wouldn't live with him. That's just talking about the ending of the agreement for labor. That's what that's talking about. All right, so when a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master, who is designated for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her as a foreign people, since he has broken faith with her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her as with a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food or clothing or her marital rights. And if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing without giving him money. Okay, so now what's this? Again, it's that we have to understand the bride price system. And more than likely, what seems to have happened here is a poor father that sometimes did this, gave their daughters to be married to rich and rich families, and be a step up for that particular family. And if that happened, but the wealthy man decided not to have her or to have her for his son, then he couldn't just say, "Oh well, I'm going to sell her to Joe Schmo over there." He's got to still care for her and either find a husband for her or let her go free. He can't just send her off like she's property. Does that make sense? Yeah.
So this is more an arranged marriage situation than a
slave
situation.
Not my slave concubine,
right? This is
more of an arranged marriage situation. We know that from the rest of the law, the legislation. Now next week it looks like we're going to have to stop, but next week we'll look at foreign slaves, and then we'll also talk about the New Testament slave system. But since we know about the exit clause already, we're already in a different universe than antebellum slavery. And we know about the voluntary system that it was. Any questions or thoughts or comments? Has it been helpful at all?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I hope so.
Yeah. What verse is the exit clause?
The exit clause, I think, is Deuteronomy 23:15. So, who would like to pray for us to close the line?
Lord Jesus.